Hello, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blog Talk Radio SED 584 Spring 2015, second call-in or second radio show of the term for Module 2. I'm your host and instructor for the graduate version of the program, Katie Stouffer. With me here in my office in sunny Gainesville, Florida, is Dr. Ruth Steiner, our guest for the program today, and also joining us is our co-host, Michelle Milam, from Instructor for the Certificate Program. So we are hopeful that you all are listening live and hopefully will chat in or call in. The guest call-in number today is 347-202-0449, so feel free anytime to call in and we can activate your mic and you can talk with us, the instructors, you can talk with our guests, we can talk to each other. Hopefully, maybe some other students will join and be able to talk with us here. So, Module 2, hopefully everyone is progressing nicely. I think the students in my section have all pretty much gotten caught up with Module 1. We had a couple of concussions and other things that slowed a couple people down, but I think we're getting caught up. And I am going home after this radio show, and I'm grading those assignments for you, I promise. So you should have that feedback very shortly after this show. Michelle, you want to talk about where your students are? You had some thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think, like you, I think everybody's pretty much caught up on Module 1, which is great. We had some a good variety of pictures of or found pictures of and talked about. I see a few of my students are a little bit behind on reading and maybe still thinking about what they're going to do for their assignment for Module 2, but I encourage you all to stick with it. The readings, I think some of them are a little heavy this week, but just know that they are there for you to come back to and reference. So think about the kind of fun activity of designing a space and putting it to test.
All right. Yeah. We did have a couple of questions in, well, I did have a couple of questions in our, in my inbox. So I don't know if everyone saw them, but I thought it'd be worth talking for a minute about what the questions people had for the Module 2 assignment. Oh, great. Looks like we have somebody on the chat. The question was, just a little bit of clarification about the task. And so this week, or this module, Ruth, we are rearranging furniture in our public spaces to see how that influences the tasks that our prototype participants do. And so the question was about, oh, can I use my office? I only have two chairs, and I could bring in a whiteboard. Absolutely. That is totally sufficient. I think I used a classroom next door, like a small conference room at Oregon State when I did it, and, rearranged a couple of chairs and maybe a table. But any small sort of space that you have access to is fine. The bigger question, I think, came down to what the task should look like. One thought somebody had was to have a group of people have a short discussion and vote on something. I like the idea of a discussion. The problem I think with that sort of vote is that once you make a decision, you can't bring those same people back in and authentically make the decision again and see how the influence of the physical space is really changing on that because they will have already made the decision. So we talked instead about, doing some sort of repeatable task like a puzzle, maybe incorporating, you could do it on a computer screen versus on an iPad. So you could have them just play a game of Tetris, for example, or you could have them working on a puzzle. The task doesn't have to be very involved. It's just something that is repeatable and in some way that the different arrangement of things could influence what they're doing. So thinking of that too, in the assignment we said specifically rearrange furniture, but I want to open that up to be a little broader that it doesn't have to be furniture. You can do things like change the lighting in the room, open a window, close a window, all of those sorts of things. So I encourage you to think a little bit broadly about what furniture and what the physical space that you're altering altering, you know, how you actually do that. So I don't know who's on the chat. If you have any further questions on that, please send them in now. Michelle, did you have any other comments on the assignment?
No, I think you really covered it. And having taught this course last year for the certificate, you know, I had people who work at museums, they use their conference room there and, you know, did the same thing like you're suggesting, turning on other lamps. They'd bring in plants from their office into the space, leaving puzzles out, books out to see if people picked up the books or not. Yeah, just think of little details to throw in there and really have fun with it. I mean, the idea is to apply some of the ideas, but consciously think about what you're putting in there, but don't overthink it at the same time.
Yeah, that's a good point. The one other question that people did have was how many people they should use. I think it's, you know, of course, depending on your space, you're not going to want to have, you know, a big group of people. You certainly don't need a big group of people. If you have a small group of 2 to 3 people, that's fine. So you can either run, you know, a couple, I would say you need to do a minimum of 3 rounds with either the individual or the group. And, you know, if you're going to do an individual doing the task, I would say that, you know, run them through 3 times, then probably ask at least one other person and run them through 3 times. If you have a small group, maybe run the 2 or 3 people through 3 or 4 iterations. Again, with prototyping, the real idea is to try a couple of variations and learn from each iteration. So be sure that when you have run them through the task, whoever it is, be thoughtful based on their based on your observations of them in that first round in changing things in the second round. So if there are further questions, of course, please use the discussion boards or email and stuff to contact us. But without further ado, let's get to our special guest. So Ruth is a colleague of mine here at the University of Florida, and you know, I thought she'd be really interesting for this module. There was a little confusion, I guess, in my version of the course. We had readings, extra readings from previous year's speaker, and so I think Nanette asked a question about interior colors for adults, and that's not actually Ruth's specialty. She actually works more in exteriors and kind of the broad community and bigger scale things. So Nanette, I would encourage you to maybe contact Dr. Reed through OSU. I assume that person is still there. I think it's a she, but I'm not entirely sure. You know, perhaps ask your question there. But I thought what was complimentary about Ruth's expertise is that we spend a lot of time in this course. A lot of us in free choice and informal learning kind of default to museum as the out-of-school space. But I want to encourage people to think more broadly. And, you know, and many of our students are from museums, working in museums, but we have people working in national parks. We could have people working for summer camps. So, you know, I thought it was really great that your expertise would kind of complement that, in that the readings and things, you know, probably focus more heavily on the interior spaces and even the assignment. But so I'm really interested to hear you tell us about your work and how you see, you know, this broader scale design of communities kind of impact how people might learn based on how they would use the space. So maybe start with telling us a little bit about who you are and how you got here and what you're doing, and then we can maybe get into some questions. So
okay, just as background, I'm a professor of urban and regional planning and the director of a center on health and the built environment. My research largely focuses on walkability, how we think about what induces people to walk in their community, and walk and bicycle, active transportation, I would call it. And my work has really evolved from trying to explain, in my dissertation, I looked at what causes people to walk to their neighborhood shopping center, to looking at how state policies. But all of them, I would say a couple characteristics is this idea of multi-scalar analysis, A second is the regulation, the activities that people engage in with each other, sort of an encouragement aspect of it.
Yeah.
And really understanding how do we overcome social norms that really make it much easier for us to drive everywhere.
Mm.
Parking is free everywhere you go. I park my car or I can spend a lot of time walking. I'll be much
Overall is a three components. It's a personal characteristics, a social and cultural, and then this one, which is the physical. So we have three courses that go along in that. And you talked about kind of a social aspect that I think your work is looking at how the physical interacts with that social aspect of overcoming the norm and things like that. And, you know, it just sort of intrigues me how right on the metro, and even here in Gainesville, our two museums on campus are on a relatively, I would say, extensive for this area kind of bus system. So I think that's pretty accessible. So, yeah, I think some of those ideas might be interesting to explore how, you know, starting at the planning level, how we might encourage people to use these physical spaces to learn more. So do you, when you're doing a community plan, do you think about how things like museums and other learning spaces, I know you've talked about shopping centers and schools in particular, but how do those, or even public libraries, how do those fit into these plans?
I think there's two answers to that. One, and well, or there's multiple answers to that, actually.
Sure.
One is that what I find in this research I've been doing on schools is that you have a school district, school board that decides where they're building their school.
Mm.
And they don't always necessarily talk to the local government that's regulating where land, where residential development is taking place. The ideal place for a school is near where there's lots of homes.
Right.
Of course, there's always trade-offs we make. But you can begin to sort of multiply that sort of with any one of these other kinds of destinations in the sense that when you're looking at a museum, when you're thinking about where you locate it, and I know this community just went through the Cave Museum, the new facility.
Right, right.
And that, what's interesting about that one is it's going to be.
Let me just step aside for a second. For those of you not familiar with Gainesville, since a lot of our folks are in Oregon and a lot of places, so we have two museums on campus here, a natural history museum and an art museum. Those were the two I was actually just talking about were on the bus system. And the other museum that Ruth just mentioned, the Cade Museum, is one that is going to be built, hopefully, in the next couple of years. They're actually fundraising for it. And it's actually going to be, quote-unquote, downtown. Now, you have to know a little bit about Gainesville, and maybe you can help me out here. But as a recent transplant to Gainesville, the downtown area is strangely enough, not exactly in the center, although it's sort of the hub of the public transit. It's certainly where the main station for the public transit is. But anyway, so then there's a lot of the population is actually heavily on the west of downtown with a little bit of the population and certainly a lower socioeconomic population on the east of downtown rather than sort of spread a little more evenly. So the Cade Museum is actually going to go slightly south of the actual downtown area, but on Main Street, which is technically the main street, except, again, by the weight of where the kind of, again, especially the affluent population and even the student population, the university and a lot of the folks are kind of more to the west and northwest. So in this part of town, just a little bit south and southeast, it's kind of industrial and kind of revitalizing, right?
Yes.
So So
how do I think about this? I mean, I actually think the challenge is that at a time when we should have been planning to go east, we went west because we built the interstate, and that became the magnet for westward expansion. I actually believe in the long term we will appreciate that we did build this museum in the downtown area for a couple of reasons, and largely one, yes, it is near a transit hub, although I would say that the way I think about the transit system is there's really two transit systems. There's one that's very frequent service that's centered around the university.
Sure.
Frequent direct service for students.
Yep.
And there's one that's into the downtown that's infrequent and much more circuitous. And there's a couple of routes that connect the two to them. And Katie is correct in that the move toward west away from where this museum is being built makes you wonder why you're building it there. On the other hand, in terms of thinking about community amenities, it's in the middle of what will become a major park.
Mm-hmm.
It has bike trails
yep.
right adjacent to it, and probably the beginning of a network of very connected off-road bicycle facilities, which means that the Cave Museum, again, which is planning to have children's STEM education, is going to be well connected so that parents can, in fact, make it into a multi-stop trip, even if they do need to drive there. But it sort of goes to the way I think about this is that you're asking generally museums is that if you what I like about the siting of the Cave Museum is in fact that there was a lot of discussion about what are the other things that we would want near museums, where do we have land that is accessible to multiple modes of transportation. The recognition that there's a very well-developed bicycle infrastructure, and in fact, one of the routes goes all the way out to Archer, which is a small community that's to the west, that's about 20 miles from. There's a whole regional network of transit that's connecting into this museum, and it goes in really both directions out from near the point at which the Cave Museum is being sited. And so, if you sort of, there's a lot of discussion here about, you know, how do you get people when you come into a museum? But the way I think about it is you have to go even further back and say, and one of the things that's somewhat unfortunate in the way that we designed our cities is that sometimes, and it's in the physical design discipline, you have interior designers who look at in the worst case, they look at only the interiors of the buildings they're working at. The architects look at the building as a box on the position it's located. The landscape architects look at the landscaping, and they might take you from a parking lot into the building. And then we have the traffic engineers build the road, but they don't necessarily build the sidewalk that connects to the parking lot. That's
I've found that for sure.
And so when you look at the worst case, and we have our silos too frequently. But if you look at the best case for a resident of the community, is I get too near the museum. However, I get there. If I live close enough, I walk. If I live close enough, 3 to 5 miles, I can bike. I end up going there. But if I drive, but every one of those modes, what you need to think about is it's really multi-scalar. How do I get from the road into the parking lot? Once I'm in the parking lot, how do I switch modes from walking to going to the inside? And that it's a continuous thought instead of, oh, I have the stairs in a place I can't get access to, and the only way I can get in is by elevator or all the simple things. But I would say it's paying attention to details, but it's also recognizing how users interact within the environment in which they're operating.
That's really, I think, really great. That actually leads me maybe to the question that Michelle, your student, brought up last year about the interiors. Do you want to ask that? I don't know that we have that right in front of us. But so connecting back to our assignment from last week. So last week it was, we were looking at the entrances to museums. And so I think, you know, that's certainly a question for a lot of us is how do we get people to our facilities? We have some dedicated, loyal visitors, if you will. And especially people that grow up with museums in particular tend to then take their families. But Michelle, you wanna ask that question?
Yeah, I think what he was trying to gauge is drawing that intrinsic motivation to return to a space. So how can we take exterior design or what you've already talked about, just accessibility to spaces, into consideration to make people want to keep coming back?
I think that, well, the one piece I think is this sort of making it seamless and not making people have to think about mm-hmm. getting to this space. I'm going to do a little detour
yeah.
into transit, because I've often believed that one challenge to getting people to use transit is that it's almost like a foreign language.
Mm-hmm.
That either you're in the in-group or you're not a transit user. And if
yep.
you're a transit user, you have these little schedules and you know how to read them and you know which side of the street you need to be on to get to where you're going and what time the bus is going to show up and where you need to transfer and all of those things. And
how much it costs.
And
you know.
How much it costs and whether, you know, what you have to use
yep.
to get on. And I've come to believe that that's the poor example.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I will also say in the research on walking, there are some lessons on that, which is that what we know, and this is, I mean, this is not the core of what I do, but there's
mm-hmm.
a lot of research that has looked at things like making it comfortable for people to walk.
Yep.
And for instance, in a climate like Florida, the natural thing is trees,
mm-hmm.
oak trees,
mm-hmm.
trees that provide shade.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you can extend that beyond that. I've used a very specific example here,
sure.
but when I think of museums, I think one place to make it memorable, and I often think about this, is airports. There are certain airports when you get off the plane, you know that you're in Seattle and Portland. Both of them have these wonderful walls that are very much in the vernacular, and there are things about that region that say, this
huh.
is the region I am in. And if you extend that into museums, you want it to be of the place rather than placeless. And... So that's one piece, and that's where
mm-hmm.
you begin to make it memorable. If you know, it's like many other things. If people don't feel welcome,
mm-hmm.
they're going to respond in kind and not come back.
So is part of that, you know, maybe the idea of fitting in with the surrounding architecture, assuming that there is a place that has a, you know, reasonable architecture that is noticeable. I mean, I know there are some places, I hate to diss on my hometown of Houston, but people always say, oh, there's no zoning in Houston, so things are just kind of all over the place. And I've read that that's actually a little bit disingenuous, but, you know, places, I guess I think of maybe like Boston as a place with some pretty distinctive architecture. You know, I was just in Chicago. Chicago has a variety of architecture, but like downtown has just, it has a variety, but all kinds of bigger buildings and sort of a feel to it. So is that sort of what you're saying?
Well, I think it's architecture is one piece, but
okay.
I would actually extend it to say it is also things like landscape architecture. And then the landscaping, it's also colors you're using.
Okay.
Again, you know, as garish as they are, orange and blue would sell really well here. And Cade, you know, invented a Gatorade, so something in that putrid green I possibly might be memorable in that kind of context.
Right. And also great for little kids. So, yeah.
Yeah, and so some of that's also what group are you targeting for. If you're going towards kids, you're really probably
mm-hmm.
more bright colors.
Right.
Whereas when you're going to adults, more local, regional theme, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in some respects, except you do need to have sort of a consistency.
Sure. Sure.
And that is something that we do think about in terms of walking, because, you know, when people can get disoriented in environments where the streets, even the setbacks of houses or buildings are in different areas across along the street, because the street
oh.
wall creates a sense of enclosure, for instance.
Okay.
And so people, and there's not a whole lot of research on that. I had a student do a dissertation on that several years ago where he was trying to look at, you know, the ratio between building height and the width of the street and the sidewalk is a part of that. And it gets complicated because the speed of cars also affects pedestrians' perception along the street wall.
Wow. Yeah, yeah.
But if you sort of move that towards, you know, when you're going to a museum, you want the slow speed. You
mm-hmm.
want the sense of slowing down. You want the sense of engagement of the things that are there. You probably want people to throw away their electronic items unless you're looking to engage them with the display. So some of that, it's really, I would say, one piece is paying attention. The other is sort of a consistency.
Mm-hmm.
People, disorientation is hard on people.
Yeah, and actually that's something that I think we talk a lot about in our buildings, again, you know, within museum, libraries, whichever kind of informal learning space. And I would imagine even so in like a national park, you know, even worse, because you get disoriented there, you could find yourself, you know, really lost. At least in a building, you have some sorts of constraints that you're like, okay, well, I haven't left the building. So, yeah. Well, great. I think this is really, really fascinating so far. I see we have another guest on the chat, and I want to remind folks that the call-in number is 347-202-0449. I'm here with Ruth Steiner of UF's Department of Urban and Regional Planning and the Center for Health and the Built Environment.
Yes.
Excellent. Okay. Yeah, the titles get so long. I mean, they're really important, but, you know, remembering them. So, Michelle, I don't know if you've got any questions. We've certainly got another few that we could go into here. Got anybody else
I
that you want to?
Yeah, I don't have any other questions, but I do just want to make a comment on what Ruth was just talking about. You know, last week when we were orienting people towards for their module one activity and thinking about these museum entry spaces that they had to find and discuss, you know, whether or not they were pleasant or unpleasant and why. And I think it's really interesting what Ruth was just mentioning about kind of getting in this right state of mind. So I know at least one student who mentioned that parking was rather far away from their entry, and it was this big grassy opening sidewalk. And of course, that does reduce accessibility for some people who may need, you know, to park closer to front doors. But I'm just thinking about how that space does orient a person, their mindset before they enter a museum, and how important that is to kind of disconnect from that, you know, technological world, of course, like Ruth was saying, unless that's your goal of going into the museum. So, you know, we were really encouraging people to think a lot about these spaces, and I think that just kind of drives that point home, that it's not just the front door, it's not just the foyer, but this whole landscape around the museum and what we're really trying to set visitors up for when they come through the front doors as well.
That's quite true.
Yeah, so. I think it's really interesting. I mean, I didn't give Ruth a whole lot of background on the course, and obviously I could see the connection since I invited her, and I was like, oh, you know, I bet this would be really cool. But, you know, it's funny you say, well, my experience and my expertise isn't with interiors, but I think a lot of what you're saying that you consider, like you say, on a different scale is the same sorts of things we would consider inside, and that, again, our readings have talked about this week. So I hope you all, students and everyone listening, are finding those same connections. And please, if there's something that resonates with you, even as a comment, you know, chat in, call in, you know, this is not necessarily for us to just talk to each other, although obviously we could do that for quite a while, but we really would love to get you guys involved in the discussion if you have thoughts.
And I'm just going to throw in one more idea, too, if I can, Katie, if you don't mind. I'm finding it fascinating, just as an avid walker around my own town and learning how to navigate my space close to home. And that's actually something that we're going to talk about later on in the course. So I really appreciate this, but I also want to, for anybody listening live or on the chat, to be thinking about how we're defining free choice learning, too, that it is not just these museum spaces or built organizations, but it's a lot of just our everyday lives, you know, sitting on your computer and Googling, learning how to surf, and all of your environments that you're surrounded by in any free choice learning, not necessarily informal learning. So keep that in mind as we're having this discussion too.
Yeah, actually that's a great point that, you know, I think is really important. And one kind of structured but outdoor opportunity that I want to share with you all that I just ran across in Chicago this weekend was, so they have a very famous park along Lake Michigan shoreline downtown, and they have Millennium Park, and Grant Park, I guess, is also a part of it. It's huge. It runs for a mile or two. You know, it echoes, you know, Central Park in New York and some of the other big Olmsted parks, I think, but When I was walking around down there, I found this kind of, cell phone or really a smartphone sort of tour, but it was all about place. And I want to look up on my phone here what exactly, if I can remember what it was, but it was about the views. And again, like I said, Chicago's architecture is pretty famous. And so it was trying to talk a little bit about, what was it? About the main architects, sort of
Sullivan, and
yeah,
I mean Chicago had the first skyscrapers in the U.S.
Yeah,
they were known for it, and they have mm-hmm. this beautiful. I assume you took that too.
I've done the skyscraper before, okay. And I went up the Willis Tower this time.
Okay.
But this was I think his name was Burnham.
Daniel Burnham
yeah.
made no small plans. They don't. I don't. They're afraid. I'm going to have to paraphrase it, but it basically said make no small plans because they don't draw people's interest and motivate them to want to be better. Make only grand plans.
There you go. Okay, I think it's called viewchicago.org, and it's a series. I actually ran across it looking at the ground, which I know you're like. You're supposed to be looking up when you're walking around and being social, but there was a little marker on the ground, and then I found the signs as well. So it says it showcases one of the most dramatic urban vistas in North America, the sweeping panorama linking the iconic Chicago skyline to Grant Park and the lakefront. So you can look it up on your smartphone or even your just the computer, yeah. The old-fashioned technology. And if you go to the ViewPath or the ViewPath mobile experience, that's really got the tour app, and it has a little map, and it starts with the bean, if you all are familiar with the Cloud Gate sculpture that looks like a really reflective mm-hmm. bean that's been down there. It goes past the Buckingham Fountain. It actually takes you down to the Field Museum and things like that, too. But I just found it really fascinating, and again, you actually don't go in any of the buildings. In fact, you're looking at the buildings, and it talks about his urban planning yeah. view, basically, for the city. And so
I found his quote.
Oh, good.
It's
okay.
It's a wonderful quote. It says, make no little plans. They have no magic to stir men's blood and probably will themselves not be realized. Make big plans. Aim high in hope and work. Remember that a noble logical diagram once recorded will never die, but long after we are gone will be a living thing, asserting itself with ever-growing insistence.
Yeah, great. So I think that's a really cool way to think about, again, really pushing ourselves beyond free choice learning in a museum setting, and really expanding that. So that's, it's funny that it's an easy thing for us to connect to people who are like, what is free choice learning or even what is informal learning? We're like, oh, out of school. And so, like you would do in a museum. And that draws an easy parallel for people to start with as an anchor. Unfortunately, we sometimes anchor too much on that. But anyway, so I encourage you to check that out and all sorts of tours. I saw a Segway tour, of course, while I was down there, too. And those sorts of things, or bicycle tours. Oh, I've been some amazing bicycle tours in Europe and in D.C. They used to do one that was a D.C. geology tour. So anyway, again, thinking broadly about these sorts of things. And as Michelle said, as we go through the course, expand your idea of physical. And so I think that's a really, really powerful thing. So turning back to some of the questions that I saw, based on your expertise, I really liked this idea of safety, and it made me think about, we talk about in schools often needing emotional safety and needing to feel like, you're in a space where you can ask a question. And I think in a museum, like you pointed out with the public transportation, being in a place where you know how to navigate is a big thing. But maybe we can talk, turn a little bit to that safety side of things and how that might help us navigate the physical and allow us to be able to learn something and think broadly. So,
well, I think I want to take in Michelle's comment about walking in her neighborhood.
Sure.
I think, I'm going to bring it back into the question of safety, because I think one of the unfortunate things that we've seen in cities, and especially when it looks to children, and I noticed your last child in the woods. But even beyond that is this whole idea of free play and letting children explore their neighborhood independent of adults.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be that that's a space for museums to begin to do that, in that we no longer allow children to walk because of our fear of safe security, is what I'm going to use as the word, because we fear the boogeyman in the neighborhood. And we sometimes have this challenge, but there's a lot of research on this that, for instance, shows that the more children wander in their neighborhood, the broader their map is when you have them draw it. And that children who are driven around by their parents only draw their house and then maybe their driveway and maybe their neighborhood, but their range of experiences when they draw it is much more limited because they don't have a kinesthetic sense of moving through a lot of different spaces. Whereas if you look at it historically, you have kids drawing the rail line and the woods and a number of these other things.
Wow.
So I think that's one challenge for this generation, really, of parents. And I'm not a parent, so, and yet I understand their concern about safety and security. But I also, you know, I also know from other things I hear that, you know, that, and as you think about it, that you do it in one step at a time.
Mm, sure.
That is, you can, and that's where the Safe Routes to School gets interesting, in the sense that it encourages them to go with an adult.
Yep.
But they then become familiar with it, and over time you could begin to have less and less supervision on the same route. You could even work with the children and identify places that they ought to be concerned about. Both, I would say, both personal safety from someone that may not have their best wishes in mind, but there's also places where crossing the street is not safe. And but that's the kind of things that I think parents can have a role in educating them and doing that. I've sort of watched this over time with friends whose children get around by walking and bicycling have a much broader view of their city than the ones who go straight into the car, because in a sense the car is this cocoon. So going back to your safety, I mean, there's really the pedestrian safety, and there are, I mean, a challenge of how we've designed our city is that we can go to long stretches where if you're a pedestrian and you're trying to get to a bus stop on the other side of the street.
Yep.
You need to be able to judge how fast these cars are going when the speed zone is 30, 45 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the nearest bus stop to my house is 5 lanes of traffic.
Wow.
Including turn lanes. So it's 2 in each lane and 1 with turns. And I need to cross that, and they've got cars coming from both directions at 45 miles an hour.
Wow.
And so in a sense, we're also not designing.
Mm-hmm.
For all users of the system.
Right, right.
And that's, you know, that's kind of a challenge. And I'm on the extreme in terms of, you know, I know what it takes for me to get across, and I'm an advocate for, you know, walking and bicycling in the community, but in the face of those kind of...
Sure.
And but if we extend that even beyond this, you get into things like, what about the person who cannot drive because they have cognitive or physical disabilities?
Mm-hmm.
Are they going to have any more luck? Probably have more trouble getting across the fine lane road than me as a healthy adult can.
Right.
Or even have visual limitations.
Yep.
And sometimes we're asking people to walk an extra half mile to get to a safe cross.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I'm, you know, and the challenge of it is that is how we mix speeds of movement.
Yep.
We've designed, as some people say, we've just designed for the automobile without designing for humans.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And how can you deal with all of these safety security things? I mean, I think there is a role in museums that possibly goes into the education piece, which is the sort of not the inreach into museums, but maybe the outreach.
Yep.
If you think of some things like, what do you call it? Where you do the where the kids have to find things out in their community instead of inside the museum.
Oh, in a scavenger hunt.
Scavenger hunt. That's the word. I couldn't come to that word. I mean, but I think that's an example where even though you probably need to involve parents to some extent in these, but they allow them to have access to other places in the community that they might not have.
Mm-hmm.
That's where, when I see the geocaching, I sort of think about that, because it gets
Yeah.
people, it gets people to go to places
Yep.
that are quite unusual. So that's safety, security, familiarity often gets eliminates some of the edge of the security question.
And I think, you know, again, that goes back to whether people visit some of these spaces, even a library. You know, if you didn't go to a library as a kid, do you even know that, I mean, heck, it has movies, it has DVDs, it has, or you know, CDs, it's got so many more things besides books. But, you know, if you don't get accustomed to it, maybe when you're young, or you don't have this sense of adventure, you know, yeah, you can get...
Or you don't have a car to get there.
Well, and that too, yeah. Yeah, so that's really it's such a complicated problem. But again, I think that really echoes sort of what we're thinking about inside or within our spaces, whether those be outdoor spaces or indoor spaces.
Even scale is another piece of it.
If you
think about the difference between a 5-lane road and a 2-lane road.
Okay.
And often how the trees, and sometimes on these 5-lane roads, there's not many trees on the side, so there isn't any sense of enclosure. The Wild West, wide open. Whereas you feel safer, I mean, just even in a physiological sense, a psychological sense, think about walking in, you know, I walk in my neighborhood a lot, and there's no sidewalks, but there's two-lane streets and not a lot of traffic.
Yeah.
And there's a very good tree canopy enclosure, and I always feel, you know, kind of cozy in those spaces.
Yeah, that's really, again, I think that echoes a lot of stuff we talk about. Again, I'm going back to museums because that's where my background is too, but, you know, you think about especially like the children's rooms and you talk about, you know, the physical fatigue of walking and standing in a museum and the need for benches and things. And when I first started at the Maryland Science Center as an exhibit manager, my exhibit had very few, it had a few stools at the exhibit places. In fact, did we even originally have those? I'm trying to remember. We got stools for school programs because we wanted the kids to sit and, you know, act like a school classroom when they were in there. But I don't know if we originally had them out in the, we must have. But beyond the stools, we found the power of a bench, you know, moved in just to let people sit and kind of absorb the room. And it wasn't even a big room. And just sort of watch and not necessarily be at a station, you know, really allowed people to kind of linger, or as their kids were playing with something, the parents could take a rest for a minute. And that, yeah, that sense of coziness. And somebody in the module one activity talking about, again, the entrance to the Maryland Science Center, you know, talked about how cavernous it looked and perhaps unwelcoming to people. Again, and it's funny because I worked there. I always thought it was pretty cool looking and it was like modern and fun. But it could be overwhelming and not cozy and, you know, and uninviting if it's, you know, a person that's not familiar with that sort of thing.
Well, even in neighborhoods, I mean, if you think about many places having a bench every so often. It's even more important as we look as we age, any old and young, where you tire out at different points.
It's true.
And not just bus stops I'm talking about.
Yep.
But you compare that to things like outdoor spaces.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of times when you have trails where it's not unusual to have the benches every so often to be in and take a break.
Yep.
But I sometimes think that we've not taking our lessons from those natural spaces to more urban spaces, which is somewhat interesting.
Yeah, well, as humans, we don't learn very fast, right? Sometimes.
some of it also is that you don't really have anybody who's thought about all of the spaces continuously.
Right.
If you've got the transportation department, the public works doing the roads, and you've got the city doing the sidewalks, and you've got the property owner doing something else, and they don't talk about it, and they don't coordinate, you know, it's just, sometimes it's a matter of just wanting the right person saying, why aren't we putting benches here to make it easier to walk?
Right.
And maybe it's there's lots of people who can do that. I do like your Open Streets Initiative, and I do want to talk a little bit about
that. Okay. Yeah,
unless there's other questions.
I'm not seeing anything. I mean, I'll remind everyone last 10 minutes here, the call in number 347-202-0449, or those of you on the chat, you know, feel free to chat in questions. But yeah, another question that I had is recently, I guess over the past 8 or 9 months in Gainesville, we've had two instances of an open streets initiative is what, I guess it's what it's been called. And I remember in Baltimore, there would be some days that they would shut down the I-83 Interstate Expressway and you could bike or walk on it. And then in D.C., I know they close one of the roads through the main park that Rock Creek Park, regularly on the weekends. And so for Gainesville, we shut down University Avenue, which is the one that's actually perpendicular to Main Street and runs east-west, the main kind of thoroughfare through town. And they closed down 8 or 9 blocks from...
About 12.
12 blocks, okay. From, you know, including downtown, not all the way to the school itself, but maybe halfway to there, and opened it up, and they had vendors, and it was to encourage downtown, you know, participation in the merchants along University and in downtown, you know, we'd get a lot of traffic. But, so yeah, talk about how that fits in and how that can maybe be a learning space or wherever you wanted to take that. So.
Well, I think about your sort of personal, social, and physical,
mm-hmm.
you know, you have this street that has a defined function that everybody takes for granted in the community. This is where all the cars go. And,
mm-hmm.
and if you look historically at this, the section of roadway, it used to be a two-lane road with very nice oak trees
oh.
that hung over. And it had wide sidewalks.
Okay.
And it's been changed to 4-lane, trying to move all these cars. The sidewalks are, in some places, not as wide as they might be.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, they initially called it open streets, and then they call it active streets.
Ah, right, right. Mm-hmm.
And mild change in emphasis, but they set up booths in the middle of the street.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I sort of, but it was opportunity for any group that was engaged in environmental education to have a booth. Anybody, there were lots of groups out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't go to the first event. I went to the second
mm-hmm.
event.
Mm-hmm.
And, but what some people, now it starts on a Cyclovia is where it comes from,
mm-hmm.
where they close streets in, I believe it was Bogota, Colombia.
I think so.
To
mm-hmm.
encourage bicycling.
Yep.
But it's not, as you suggest, it's not unlike Golden Gate Park in San Francisco closes
mm-hmm.
the street and only allows rollerbladers and bicyclists and pedestrians on weekends. So I see it a bit in that way, but I also see, you know, and I think the essential question is how does that behavior in that space for a short period of time, does it ever really translate
mm.
into people seeing it as a different place
mm-hmm.
and seeing possibilities for a different way of using that same urban space
yeah.
at other times?
It yeah.
comes in what is called tactical urbanism.
Mm.
And the idea is the other kinds of strategies you've seen with tactical urbanism is things like taking a parking space and turning it into a pop-up park.
Yes.
And again, you can envision that people begin to say, well, urban space is valuable. Why are we only allowing it for cars and their greedy use of space?
Mm.
Now, I sort of don't know the answer to what's going to happen. I've
mm-hmm.
been pushing one of my students who's evaluating both of the open streets again.
Oh, great.
Doing surveys of both the businesses and the participants in
mm-hmm.
the program. But the essential question is, does this change people's values or does it set them in stone? Because some people who are really automobile-oriented are never going to change their mind.
Mm.
And the people who are really bicycle-oriented are going to do what they're going to do.
Right.
I think it's a creative way to think about it. But I also think, you know, the idea of tactical urbanism, and I'm thinking about the assignment you were talking about, because
mm-hmm.
it almost seems like there would be an opportunity in museums to think about using spaces differently
yep.
and simply having a pop-up display
yep.
that shows up randomly, and then you get people guessing when it might happen. Or
Right.
Or how they might use it, or you can end up, and you might end up deciding that a space that you had set in your mind for a certain use,
mm-hmm.
in a tactical urbanism sense, but we'll call it something else.
Sure.
You might decide that's a way to bring in human interest. So maybe
mm-hmm.
these cavernous entrances to museum, you might be able to take half the space.
Yep.
And put up a pop-up park or another event on the other part and reuse that space in a creative way that allows your visitors to see your place differently, may allow, like the on-street vendors, the truck rallies are the other example.
Food truck rallies,
rallies.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's another way to create interest, and
mm-hmm.
there may be other creative ways to use what is essentially underutilized space. Now, it may never change people's attitude about that basic space, or it may be that they're displaced, their ideas are displaced to other places.
Yeah.
You know, maybe they will never see this four-lane road as anything other than a four-lane road.
Uh-huh.
But they might say, you know, there is something to be said, so maybe we do need to provide bicycle facilities a block over or two
mm-hmm.
blocks over or something of that sort.
Yeah, we haven't even touched on the experiment that they did last year. They took a four-lane road, actually made it two lanes and a bike lane on either side, and then recently had a community vote, and it actually went back to four lanes.
No, it wasn't a community vote. It was a city commission who decided they didn't like it.
Oh, well, okay. I remember a petition, at least, that I got to sign. But, yeah, so experiments that way sometimes. So that's a whole conversation for another day. But, you know, I think it would be great if you have some of these references. I mean, maybe your student hasn't done any of that work yet, but if you have anything.
She's attending in weeks.
Oh, great. Yeah. Well, if she's got some publications or things, you know, our folks might be interested if you can share those with us. I'll put those up on the discussion boards. But, yeah, that actually, okay, to defend the Maryland Science Center for a little bit, and, you know, I'm sure it was designed with an architect who was not necessarily integrated with the education purposes and whatever, you know. But we did, you're exactly right. It was a three-story atrium, and there were stairs as a central feature, which was actually pretty cool. But on weekends, we would do egg drop contests from the third floor for a while, and we would also have some of our explainer carts come out and do, on the main level, they would do helium balloon sorts of things, you know, that would go up. So you're right. That's an exactly, I think, a way to think about that. So bringing it back to the assignment, for those of you all who are still wondering, that could be a way to potentially do your assignment is, you know, take that conference room and turn it into a gym for a second, you know, like how actually, you know, we did yoga some evenings in empty spaces in the museum just because, you know, we all wanted to do some yoga and somebody
there's
was
yoga on the access streets again.
Yeah, there's yoga
at the
access streets. So, you know, think broadly when you're doing your assignments, and I encourage you really to, you know, take what Ruth has shared with us and incorporate that. Well, so we have about 4 minutes left. I see no chatter from the chat room. Michelle, do you wanna wrap up with anything? Jump in again?
I don't think I have anything else, but I have to say I've really enjoyed this conversation. I feel like it's been very different from what we've discussed on other radio shows for this course. So I think it's just been fascinating to hear all of the ideas.
Excellent. Yeah, and I mean, again, for those of you who may have been more interested in the interior stuff that you saw the readings from Dr. Reed from previous years, those are all archived radio shows, and you should be able to access them through this website. If you can't figure out where those are, you know, feel free to chat with Michelle or me, and we will get you access to those. So I think that's, you know, it's a challenge each year to have someone fresh but still related to the material, and I'm fortunate now to be at the University of Florida with some new contacts and things, and be able to bring those to you. So I'm curious to see how you felt that this one goes, but I'll give you a preview that I think that's the theme of the couple of other speakers we have coming up, is that trying to push your ideas a little. So in the next module, we'll talk about emotions and perception of sensory stuff, and one of Michelle's and my classmates, Dr. Laura Good, used to work in summer camps and YMCA camps, and you know, I think that was a really great fit to, again, thinking beyond the museum and thinking about the you know, use of your senses in these settings. So she'll be our speaker in 2 weeks, and then 2 weeks after that will be another colleague from the University of Florida in in computer science. She works specifically with kind of touchscreen devices and how people learn, especially how kids learn with those. But again, I think we've tried to go with some maybe people a little more complementary to the readings. Certainly, if you have questions about the readings that aren't covered, you know, that's discussion boards and questions to us, you know, are where you want to talk about those. But, you know, we hope you kind of like this format, and we're anxious to hear your feedback either through discussion boards or course evaluations or whatever, and maybe next time we'll go 20 seconds, 30 seconds? What? It still says a minute and a half. I don't understand this timing system, but if we drop off, thanks for listening live or recorded. Thanks again to Dr. Ruth Steiner, who is hopefully going to provide us with her students' successfully defended thesis or dissertation in a few days or weeks, and maybe some other resources that we think about that are related now that you've thought about what we talked about today. Maybe it said 90 seconds and I just didn't hear it. Okay. Well, so we look forward again to your questions for the radio show in upcoming weeks. Maybe now that you know we're going to go a little sideways with these, you have a little better idea. And yeah, we look forward to talking with you. And we really encourage you to call in and chat in. You know, it helps us. We don't have to do the work to come up with questions, but you know, we can if we don't have your input. You know, it's fun work for sure. And so I'm really grateful to have great colleagues in this, you know, from the OSU program and now at the University of Florida and throughout, and really, really kind of fun stuff about what we do here. So, I'll leave you with 10 seconds. Think broadly about free choice learning, and I hope we've expanded your horizons a little bit this week. So, all right, thanks, Michelle.
Thanks, Ruth. Bye, Katie.
Bye. Bye-bye. All right. Thank you so much. End episode. You sure? Yes. Yeah.